Support for WPR comes from Wills on behalf of Wisconsin Public Libraries, offering access to ebooks, audiobooks, digital magazines, and more. Available with a Wisconsin Library Card at wisconsinsdigitallibrary.org.
What's a MyRA and do you want one? How do we freeze and unfreeze our credit reports? Is it a good idea to open a Roth IRA for a teenager? And what to consider when deciding how and who should prepare and file your income tax returns? We'll get information and advice on all of these topics during this edition of On Your Money. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. And as always, financial planner Kevin McKinley also welcomes your personal finance question at 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to onyourmoney@wpr.org. Kevin McKinley is a certified financial planner, managing member of McKinley Money, LLC, and he joins us from our studios in Eau Claire. Hello, Kevin.
Hello, Joy.
So President Obama, in his State of the Union, announced this new way for Americans to save money. Tell us the details.
It was the most fascinating State of the Union address I have ever watched.
Was it really?
Yeah, I have it on DVR. If anyone wants to come over and watch it with me, more than welcome to.
Good.
It's called the MIRA account or the MyRA account. It's basically a starter retirement savings account. It will start out as a voluntary program set up by employers and give certain employees the opportunity to deduct part of their payroll check into this savings account. And it will end up kind of being like a Roth IRA.
So what are the positives of a MIRA?
There are a couple. First of all, the investment option is actually pretty neat. It's in the G fund of the Thrift Savings Plan that's only available to government employees. And that's kind of like a bond fund with no loss of principal. It's a very low interest rate, maybe 1% to 2% usually, but at least the value of it in theory can't go down. There is also a very low investment minimum of $25, and employees can put in as little as $5 per payroll period into the account. There are generally no fees to the account. It's flexible. People, once they start, they can stop again. They can raise or lower their contribution as they see fit. And if they wish, the account can be moved to another provider if they would like, or they can take it out and spend the money as they please, although they will pay taxes on any earnings that the money is made within the account, kind of, again, like a Roth IRA.
So are there downsides to a MIRA?
Yeah, there's just the one investment option right now, and also balances are limited to $15,000. I think the government was a little concerned that people would find this too attractive to get access to this particular mutual fund and put too much money in there. So you can only accumulate up to $15,000 in the account or contribute to it for 30 years, and after that you do have to move it to a private Roth IRA. There is also an earnings limit on who can make contributions to it, modified adjusted gross income of about $190,000 for married couples and about $130,000 for single filers.
Well, so what's your take on the MIRA?
Well, I think it's a nice gesture. The problem is definitely there. People are generally not saving for retirement, and those who are usually don't have enough for it. The average retirement savings balance last year, according to Fidelity, was about $63,000 in 401ks. But again, that's only people who have 401ks, and many people do not have those at all. There's a very low savings rate out there right now. Right now, only about 1 out of 10 people who can use IRAs actually do use them, and the national savings rate is about 3.9% of income right now. So there is very little saving going on right now, but there are also already investment vehicles out there like Roth IRAs that just about anyone can open up for themselves. And the problem, of course, is not that people don't have enough vehicles, it's that they don't have enough money. There was a recent Pew survey that reported that of people who make $35,000 a year or less, 75% of them are worried about losing their job. So they have much bigger concerns right now than saving for retirement, which may be 20 or 30 or 40 years down the road.
Yeah, and just help me understand, why would we need a MIRA when we already have an IRA?
I think it's something that a lot of people who are starting out and don't know how to save or where to save, if they can get it through their employer, hopefully their employer will choose to open this account for them. And if it's just deducted from their payroll check, they not only don't have to make a decision every month or every year to put money aside, but they won't notice the money as much if it is pulled out of their paycheck versus if they had to come up with, say, $1,000 or $2,000 deposit check.
Well, we have a caller who is interested in the MIRA, Dick in Oconomowoc. Hi, Dick.
Yes, good morning. Just a quick comment relative to the benefit for young people of the MIRA account. A lot of young kids are moving around, just actively engaged in life, and it's really hard to be thinking about setting funds away, let alone dealing with the paperwork, the lost accounts, where's the paperwork. But this account is a national account that will track people. And just in terms of its ease of use and its portability with individuals, it has huge advantages, and I think it'll become wildly popular.
Well, I want to kind of react to that, Kevin.
I hope you're correct, Dick, and you are right in the sense that that the path of least resistance is just having it pulled out of the paycheck, and a lot of people would be better off actually saving for retirement from 22 to 32 and then stopping and spending their money as they see fit than doing what most people do, which is starting in their 30s or 40s or 50s and trying to accelerate their savings and denying themselves some other luxuries. So I hope it works. I think that the importance is probably the symbolism in that these people can get in for a low dollar amount with very little paperwork, as Dick said. But it's also something that if you get people in the habit of accumulating money at a very early age, generally they tend to accumulate on their own once they get older and have more money. And again, we're going to talk about that a little bit later on today.
Kevin McKinley is the managing member of McKinley Money, LLC, a registered investment advisor with offices in Eau Claire and Madison. Kevin does not intend to provide personalized investment advice through this broadcast and does not represent that the securities or services that we discuss are suitable for every investor. Investors should consult with their financial advisors prior to making any investment decisions. If you have a question for Kevin, call us at 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to onyourmoney@wpr.org. And it's time now for the On Your Money email bag. And Sue in Wausau says, I shopped at Target. Following another guest's suggestions, I contacted the three credit reporting agencies and I paid for a security credit freeze for both of us. Do I still need to request an annual credit report from each of the three agencies? If I contact them, will they charge me $10 to unfreeze for this one-time report? Thank you in advance. So what do you say to that, Kevin?
Well, first of all, when she says she obtained a credit freeze for both of us, does she mean her and me?
Maybe the other guest. I don't know.
I don't know. Well, in any event, yes, Sue, you are correct in your steps, but there is some understandable confusion between a freeze and a credit report and even a credit score. The freeze, what Sue did, prevents the credit bureau. This is Experian or TransUnion and several other names. They change them about once a year. It prevents those bureaus from releasing information about you to a credit card company or, quite frankly, anyone else who is trying to get that information. And so, therefore, and in theory, a person can't get your Social Security number and try to open a credit card in your name, charge up the balance, and then abscond without paying for the money that they've spent. So the only way the credit freeze can be unfrozen is if you pay $10 to the agency to unfreeze it. And then you have to pay $10 again to the bureau to freeze it once more. And so what you typically want to do is, I think these are a very good idea, but when you do it, you want to find out if you're applying for a loan or say you're trying to lease an apartment or even you're getting a new auto insurance policy and they say, we need to check your credit report. Ask them which bureau they're going to be using and then you unfreeze it for a little while. That'll cost you $10. And then once they've received the information that they need, then you freeze it again. That'll cost you another $10. And if you want to find out how you can do this for any state in the union, go to tinyurl.com/cfreeze, tinyurl.com/cfreeze. And as always, all the websites we mentioned today will be up at our website, onyourmoney.com, later on.
So what exactly is the annual credit report?
That's the raw data that each bureau has assembled on you. And you can get access to that information. You can get one free report per bureau per year. And you can do that by going to annualcreditreport.com. And that's actually a good idea to check for accuracy, because a lot of times people find errors on the reports and the errors are negatively affecting their credit score and their ability to get loans. And if you only find out when you're trying to borrow money, usually it takes a long time to correct the errors, and that may prevent you from borrowing money that you otherwise could if the correct information were on there.
So the annual credit report is different from the credit report?
Yeah, the annual credit report is different from the credit score. The credit score is just a number that quantifies all of the raw data within the annual credit report. And there are different scores for different bureaus. There are different scores for different activities, whether it's borrowing money or trying to get auto insurance. The main provider of credit scores is myfico.com, M-Y-F-I-C-O.com, and you can get your score through them by paying a small fee. It's about $20. But there's also an advertising-supported one that's technically free, creditkarma.com, creditkarma.com with a K. That one you can get for free. It's a really neat service. I've used it myself. And then finally, many banks and credit unions are offering access to free credit scores for their members or customers. So contact your financial services provider and see if they offer that service to you.
Okay, sorry, I said that. So it's the credit score and then the annual credit report.
Correct.
All right. Let's take a call from Catherine in Oshkosh. Hi, Catherine. Catherine, are you there? Well, you know what? Catherine's either not there, can't hear us, or we can't hear her. So let me give the number, 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to onyourmoney@wpr.org. I'm Joy Cardine talking with Kevin McKinley, Certified Financial Planner, Managing Member of McKinley Money, LLC. This is On Your Money on the Ideas Network.
I need a dollar, dollar.
You're listening to On Your Money on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Joy Cardine with Certified Financial Planner Kevin McKinley, and we welcome your personal finance question for Kevin at 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to onyourmoney@wpr.org. Leah in Madison is with us. Hi, Leah. You're on the air.
Hi. My question is, my second child is going to be starting school part-time in the fall. And so we'll be saving a little bit of money on daycare, not a ton, like $40 or $50 a week maybe. And I'm just wondering where the smartest place to invest that is, which of our accounts would be the smartest place to do that. I have a 401k at work, and then my husband and I both have IRAs.
Lee, are you maximizing your 401ks right now?
No, and that's kind of what I figured you would say, but I just want to double check. I'm at like...
It's going to be the new subtitle of their show, On Your Money with Kevin McKinley. That's what I figured you would say. Yeah, Leah, that's a great idea. And the reason being, of course, is that you get an instant return on your money in the form of a lower tax bill. And for a married couple filing jointly, especially if your Line 43 income is going to be over $73,800 in 2014, the money that you set aside in that 401k will save you 25 cents for every dollar that you set aside will be saved in taxes. So that's a great rate of return. And do you know, Leah, if you can borrow against your 401ks at work?
I don't know that, but I don't think that would be an issue.
Okay, no, it's a great rate of return. And in terms of investing it, you know, that it's going to go up and down in value, especially if it's invested properly for the long term. But if you are concerned about getting access to the money, then I would have you use a Roth IRA and max those out, because you can pull the contributions out whenever you want with no taxes or penalties. The bad news about that, of course, is by making a contribution to a Roth IRA, you don't get any tax break on it.
Right, yeah. Okay. Well, thank you very much.
Thanks for the call. Good luck. Gertrude in Watertown is with us. Hi, Gertrude. What's on your mind?
Well, I have an account at a financial institution, and every month they put $1,000 into my checking account. Now, is that considered income when it's taken out of the major account and put into my checking account?
Gosh, it just sounds like a generous gift from a very nice financial institution. Gertrude, is this an IRA account or an annuity? Do you know?
Well, my husband set it up. I think it's an IRA, or, you know, he's had it for a million years, and he's deceased now.
Okay.
So my question is, I'm trying to apply for propane relief, and I have to have, you know, below such and such an income.
Okay. I'm not familiar with the income calculations for the propane relief. My guess is if it's from an IRA or an annuity that it will be counted as income. If you can check on your tax returns from 2013 and use that data, that and especially if you look at like the bottom line.
It wasn't in existence then because my husband was alive then, see.
Okay.
So we were taking the $1,000 out every month.
Okay. If that's the case, and again, I would defer to the good people at the Propane Assistance Program on this, but I'm guessing that if you were pulling it out of an IRA or an annuity, it's not only taxable income technically, but it will also count as income for the purposes of the Propane Assistance Program.
Good luck, Gertrude. I bet you a lot of people need relief from propane costs right now. Jared in Milwaukee is with us now. Hi, Jared.
Hi. I recently purchased a newer used car and took out a pretty significant loan on it. And I don't have a lot put away in savings, and I still own my older car, which is worth some money. I'm wondering, I hope to be selling my older car in a few weeks here, and I'm wondering if I should put that money towards my loan and maybe refinance and get a lower payment, or if I should put that money aside into savings somewhere and create more of a buffer for myself.
Good for you, Jared. Do you happen to know what the interest rate is on the car loan?
2.5.
Okay. Then no, I would not refinance that. That's a very good interest rate. And you can always pay that loan off, I'm guessing, without any penalty for it if you want to or need to down the road. But you're much better off accumulating savings and particularly about 6 months' worth of savings before you do anything like save for retirement or pay off any loans at all, student loans, credit cards, whatever. If you add up your typical monthly expenses, multiply that number by 6 at a minimum and 12 at an optimum, then after you get to that point in liquid savings, then and only then would I start to pay off that loan early. But otherwise, just make that minimum payment. Make sure you get your oil change regularly and keep it running well so you don't have any big repairs to tap that savings. But other than that, no, your first inclination was correct.
Hey, Jared, what's your new used car?
2011 Hyundai Sonata.
Zoom, zoom.
It's a good value.
Yeah, all right. Thanks for the call. Good luck. Have fun. Cindy in Hudson is with us. Hi, Cindy. Cindy, are you there? What's going on with callers? Calling in and then
hanging up. I think we should start sending the authorities out to some of these people's homes and vehicles.
Hey, Cindy, when you snooze, you lose. I think that's what my dad used to say. Ann in Duluth is with us. Hi, Ann.
Hi. Excuse me. I have a credit. I have a question about my credit rating. We are having a dispute with our cell phone company, a very valid dispute. We have also filed a complaint with the Wisconsin Department of Consumer Protection. Excuse me. We want to cancel our contract for service we are not receiving. And we have had problems with this from the get-go. So they are saying we owe them $400. We are saying, no, we are done with you. We want to cancel our contract. But we have almost a perfect credit rating, and we are really worried that if we don't pay them, it'll wreck our credit rating. But if we do pay them, we'll never see that money again that we absolutely do not owe them.
Oh,
yeah, and your inclinations are correct. You get the lesser of two evils here. I will ask you or say this, Ann, do you expect to be borrowing money at any time in the near future?
No.
Okay. Well, that's really the main reason that you should be concerned about your credit rating. It can affect things like, your car insurance and even, you know, as you mentioned, cell phone contracts. But the first part about the credit rating I would not fear, and especially if you feel like you're in the right on this, I would dispute the charge. And it sounds like you're doing this more out of principle than the actual $400 of the bill for it, but $400 can be a significant amount of money if you feel like you didn't get the service you were deserving. When people do run into an issue like this, and if it even does show up as a judgment on your credit report or an uncollected bill, you do get a chance to explain it to the bureaus and let the bureaus decide if this is something that they want to note on the credit report as something that you're disputing or whatever. That said, it won't devastate it. It sure won't help. But unless you're going to be borrowing money in the near term, it's probably not something that I would be concerned about until you actually resolve it one way or the other. And then if you win, great. And if you don't, then you might decide that it's worth it to actually pay what they say and move on, consider yourself the wiser.
Okay, would it be prudent for us to call the credit bureau preemptively and say this is what we're doing at this point, just so you know, or should
probably
I wait?
Not. It's probably best to just monitor it and
okay.
wait till until something shows up and you start getting some calls for it. But again, I don't think it'll actually get to that point. It shouldn't. Hopefully, you can kick it up through the channels at the company and try to resolve this one way or the other with the managers and the customer service people.
We've done that. That's why we filed the complaint. Thank you for your advice. I appreciate it.
Good luck, Ann.
Yeah, good luck. I'm sorry you're going through that. Not that anybody else cares, but I just had to verify my employment to continue to get my discount for my cell phone provider. I got a letter in the mail saying you've got to verify that you're still working for a place that we have a contract with to provide this discount. And the state of Wisconsin happens to be one of those employers, but I couldn't verify through my email or through the name of my employer. And there's, I had to, you know, they're making me send them a pay stub.
I'm just imagining you are you on the phone or in person?
This was online at first, and then I did call.
Okay, I'm just imagining you on the phone and say, can you verify your appointment? And you just taking a pause and saying, I'm Joy Cardin.
I know.
And then another pause on the other end saying, yeah, lady, I got your name. Where do you work? And I need some validation.
I did say that. I thought it was, you know, my employment was easily verifiable, but in any case, it didn't help. I had to go through the rigmarole. But anyway, I went through the rigmarole. I'm Joy Cardin with Kevin McKinley. This is On Your Money. If you have a question, 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to onyourmoney@wpr.org. Bill in Waukesha is with us. Hi, Bill.
Hi. I have a question. I'm much older than my wife, and there may be a possibility that she would want to take an early distribution from an IRA that she has before age 70 and a half. And I know there's a way to do that called something like an equal and regular distribution that is allowed, or at least I was told there was. And I was wondering if a widow's pension income has any effect on that, and how is that accomplished to get early withdrawals from an IRA?
Okay. Bill, how old is your wife?
She's 54, and I am 67.
Okay. She can. It's called the 72T regulation for IRS tax code fans out there. And what she can do is, as long as she pulls out substantial and equal payments from her retirement account, she can get the money out. It's still taxable as ordinary income, but there is no 10% penalty that would otherwise apply because she's going to be under the age of 59 and a half. It's a very tricky maneuver both to implement and to monitor, because if you ever change it or stop it sometimes, and if you do it improperly, the whole payment bill can come due. Not only will you then owe taxes on it, but you may still owe penalties on it. So it is possible, and it's called substantial and equal payments, SOEP, I think is the acronym for that.
Okay, and does a widow's pension, she will get a pension if I pass as a result, you know, she'll get my widow's pension. Does that have any effect on that IRA?
Nope, none at all. Is it your IRA that you're talking about, Bill, or her IRA?
Oh, no, it's her IRA. I set it up all in her name.
Okay.
And, you know, I just want to know if she's going to have access to that money if something should happen to me.
Yeah, well, if it's in her name you know, after 59 and a half, she can pull it out with no penalty and just pay taxes on it. And there are several different waivers of the penalty, such as, you know, there's medical emergencies, education, healthcare expenses, et cetera, that allow her to pull money out of that IRA before 59 and a half without paying the penalty. But again, any amount she pulls out will be taxable income no matter when she does it. If she's in a lower income tax bracket, though, she won't pay much in taxes on it anyway.
Thanks, Bill, for the call. Good luck to you. time now for Smart Assets. If you know a teenager who is fortunate enough to have a job, a small but generous gesture can have a big effect on the road. What gesture is that, Kevin?
That is open a Roth IRA for him or her. Now, this kid must have actually earned income. Can't be money that you know they receive for birthday or holidays, whatever. The limit on the contribution is, like the rest of us, it's $5,500 if you're under 50, or the amount of their earned income for 2013, whichever is less. And the nice thing about this is a kid can open a Roth IRA based on his or her income, even if his or her parents' income exceeds the limits for opening a Roth IRA for themselves.
So you would think you'd still have to convince your teenager to deposit the money into the Roth IRA. Is that the case?
Yeah, that's right. That would be the biggest hurdle to it, but it's not necessarily a problem if you can afford to make the contribution for yourself. Technically, the kid can spend his or her earnings however she sees fit, and then you can make a contribution to that Roth IRA for them. Some people choose to do a match and say, look, if you get, you know, for every dollar you get into this, I'll give you a dollar, or for every dollar you get in, I'll give you 10 cents or something of your own money for it. But you can make the full deposit yourself. It just can't exceed the gift limits, which are $14,000 a year of what you can give to another person without filing a gift tax return. And so if you put the money in and then you give the kid $14,000, you might run into a little bit of trouble. And it is an actual gift. If you deposit your money into a kid's Roth IRA, that is the kid's money to do with whatever he or she sees fit once he or she reaches adulthood in age only.
So why a Roth and not a regular IRA?
Several reasons. First of all, by definition, a teenager is going to have very low income and therefore pay little or nothing in taxes. And then the Roth IRA comes out tax-free in retirement. I think the rule of thumb is usually about for every dollar you get in to a Roth IRA for a teenager, they'll probably have somewhere between $20 to $30 or so tax-free in retirement. The neat thing about the Roth IRA, as we mentioned, of course, is that if the money's needed for anything, it can be pulled out with no taxes or penalties, as long as you just pull the contribution out for any reason and whenever they want.
So how does this strategy fit in with saving and paying for higher education expenses?
Actually, pretty well. If the money's in the Roth IRA in the teen's name, it probably won't affect their need-based federal aid. A private school might count it as an asset, but it's unlikely that that would be the case. And again, because the contributions can be withdrawn, they can use it to pay for school, they can use it to pay off loans down the road if that becomes a necessity. But another nice thing about this is if there's an UTMA account, which a lot of people have saved money for children in the children's name over time, you could pull the money out of the UTMA account and put it into a Roth IRA for the kid. And that will shelter it somewhat from the need-based federal financial aid formula while still not running afoul of the laws of using that money for something beyond the kid's own well-being.
So where do we start when it comes to opening a Roth IRA for a working younger person?
You have to check with the kid or the kid's parents if you are not the kid's parent. You need Social Security numbers and birth dates, et cetera. You need to find a provider. Not everybody will open a Roth IRA for a minor, but usually the larger services firms like Schwab and Fidelity, or excuse me, Vanguard, and I think TD Ameritrade still does it as well. And then usually the parent serves as the custodian for the account. They run it until the kid becomes the age of majority, which is usually 21 across the country, and then the kid gets the money as well. In terms of investment options, you probably want to pick like a target date fund for retirement, something that starts out fairly aggressive in a lot of stocks and very little bonds and cash, and then becomes more conservative as the kid grows older over the next 40 or 50 years. Neat thing about this that I've seen now in doing this for clients and other people is that the kid sees this happening and says, the people who care about me actually think I should start saving for retirement when I'm 16 years old. Maybe I should be thinking about this now as well rather than thinking about it when I'm old like they are.
Sounds good. Let's take a call from Matt in Milwaukee next. Hello, Matt.
Hello, how are you?
Good. What's your question?
It's a good parlay into what Kevin was just talking about. I have four children. The oldest is almost six, and since each one of them has been born, I opened a savings account and have been contributing monthly to each one of their savings accounts. And after reviewing some of the statements last week, it hit me that we're really not getting a good return on the money that we're putting away for them. And I was just wondering what Kevin's recommendation would be for something that would give us a little bit better return on the money that we're putting away.
What is the purpose you're going to have for the money, Mark?
Really just for whatever they need. If it's college, if it's a down payment on a house once they become an adult, if it's something that they just transfer into a Roth IRA once they start working and hit their teenage or early adult years, really anything.
Okay. The problem, as always, but especially today, is that there is a very high correlation between trying to get potential reward and incurring potential risk. And that's been demonstrated in the last few weeks of the way the stock market has gone. And there are no safe places to get what we think of as a high rate of return. And by that high rate of return, I think of maybe anything over 1% to 2%. If you're comfortable with the possibility that the money could go down 30 to 40%, you can try an index fund, a stock market mutual fund. If you're not, you're kind of stuck plugging along, not making much on it whatsoever. We will have a website of the week that we'll talk about later on today, the way that some ways that you can try to get a higher, safer rate of return on your safe money. But no, you either have to say, look, we're just going to keep plugging on this thing and hope for the best, but accept the fact we could lose a lot, or we're going to accept the fact that we're going to not lose anything, but we're probably not going to make very much either.
So there you go, Matt. Here's an email from Jason who says, I had a Roth IRA set up in 2000, but never contributed to it because it hasn't performed well, to say the least. Would it be more beneficial to set up a MIRA or start adding to this Roth? I believe the Roth will charge fees for investing, won't it?
There's a good chance it will charge fees for investing. The Roth is not an investment. The Roth IRA is technically a jar in which investments are contained. Those investments can be savings accounts and CDs. They can be bond funds. They can be stock mutual funds. They can be individual stocks and bonds. The key here, of course, is that Jason set this up in the year 2000, which was a high point then for the stock market, and many stocks and investments still have not recovered 14 years later from that point. If he's okay saying, all right, I want a very limited investment option, but I want to keep it safe, that MIRA is not a bad deal at all. But if he wants to contribute more than the $15,000 that are that MIRA account is capped at, or if he wants a wider range of investment options, he's probably better keeping the Roth IRA, incurring the few fees. But again, if you go to a low-cost or no-cost provider, there generally aren't going to be very big fees as long as you have a few thousand dollars to invest.
I'm Joy Cardine with Kevin McKinley, Certified Financial Planner, Managing Member of McKinley Money, LLC. Coming up on Your Money, we'll have some tax preparing and filing tips and more answers to your questions at 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to onyourmoney@wpr.org.
Tax is gonna break my back, I swear. Don't you know I pay a lot more than my share? I hate taxes.
This is On Your Money on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Joy Cardine with Kevin McKinley, and there are only 9 weeks left until April 15th. So you better start thinking about filing your income taxes. Oh, Kevin, really? Do I have to start?
I've got you a special dispensation.
Thank you.
You're good this year.
So where do the rest of you begin?
The rest of them should start with the ways that they can file and calculate the proper amount that they either owe or are owed. There are some advantages and disadvantages to the different methods of filing and comparing the taxes. So we'll talk about doing it yourself today and in a few weeks where you can get more help from a real live human being.
All right. Well, let's start with the cheapest way. That would be good. What's that?
That is doing it on your own with a pencil and paper. And in this era of people fearing transmitting financial data electronically, it's understandable that why some people would still prefer to fill it out with pencil and paper and then send it via regular mail. But the problem is that one of the biggest audit triggers or notices from the IRS and fines is when people make math errors and they don't add correctly and they forget to carry the 7 or whatever, and that can lead to an unfortunate notice from the IRS. If you insist on doing this, the best way to do it is to check your math several times to make sure you get the numbers right, and then mail it return certified so that you know that it went to the place it was supposed to go.
The last time I did my own taxes, I did them with, you know, pencil and paper. I can't believe it. What about electronic solutions?
About 80% of filers choose some form of electronic filing. That's a record. About 122 million filers use some kind of electronic filing solution in 2013, according to the IRS. One where you might want to start is the Free File Service. This is a consortium of tax preparation software companies that have gotten together and, with the blessing of the IRS, allow most people to use their service to file a free federal income tax return. Now, there are limits. You have to have $58,000 or less of adjusted gross income. That usually is about 90% of tax filers fit into that category. But the forms actually can be used by anybody for any income. There might be some extra cost to it if you need to file a state return along that. It might be $10 or $20. And then if you need to file any extra returns for, you know, Schedule D or whatever, if it's more complex, you're going to pay to do that as well. But otherwise, it's a pretty good way to have your federal tax returns done for free. And with any time you do electronic filing, yes, you do have to pay the money sooner, but you also get the money back sooner if you are expecting a refund.
Yeah. So what about software? Can we buy software that will help us?
Yeah, you can get a link to them through that free file program at freefile.irs.gov. But there are three big ones you can approach directly. TaxAct, H&R Block has a home version, and then TurboTax is probably the biggest and the best. The cost is going to run between $30 and $90. H&R Block is kind of neat because it's the easiest way to connect to a human who might be, you know, within driving distance if you do need to talk to somebody. TaxAct is the cheapest one. It's out of Iowa. It's kind of a unique software program, but that one you can get into for around $20 to start. TurboTax, generally, they still do have live help, ostensibly anyway, but they also have a very good questioning program to ask you questions, and then when you answer one or the other, that triggers other questions. Some people are a little down on TurboTax lately because they sense a lot of upselling, that they're trying to direct people towards certain products. But the neat thing about it is many of these programs will actually import data directly online into the form for you. The disadvantage, of course, is that you are transmitting this data over the e-waves, and if you're concerned about that, I would suggest that you actually get a disk and buy the software and install it directly on your PC.
All right, good. I do have a live real person preparing taxes. You'll be talking more about that next week, or that when you're back?
Yeah, we'll talk about it in a couple weeks.
Talking with Kevin McKinley, Certified Financial Planner, Managing Member of McKinley Money, LLC. If you have a personal finance question for Kevin, call us at 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to onyourmoney@wpr.org. John in Wisconsin Rapids is with us. Hello, John.
Hello. Unlike my precise and well-placed knowledge of where to find the always useful Kevin McKinley on your money, I don't know where my misplaced stock certificate is, and they want 5% to replace the stock certificate. Is there another way to get it, or do you have any advice?
That is an unfortunate downfall of losing a stock certificate. John, do you know what the value of the certificate is?
Approximately 8,000.
Okay. Then I'm guessing the 5% is probably some form of bonding fee, correct?
It's just a fee. I'm not sure. It's just I've contacted them and they said that there's a 5% replacement fee.
Okay. Usually that fee is actually kind of an insurance so that they can say, all right, we're finding something that in theory you could already have owned and sold. And it kind of bonds it and protects the company from liability from giving you a new certificate that you've already sold. And you're obviously not doing that because you're a good and decent person, but there's a chance that that could happen. I think it's the only way, unless you can come up with another way to sell it, the only way to get the $8,000 is to pay $400 to get the bond and everything like that. I think it's well worth it. And sorry, there's no other answer to it other than, you know, get up in the attic and start digging through those boxes and see if you can find it again.
Thank you. Appreciate the program.
Good
Thank
luck, John.
You, John. Good luck. Mark in Oshkosh is next. Hello, Mark.
Hi. My question is, last year I received an inheritance on a transfer on death account. Do I have to claim any of that this year in my tax returns? I didn't receive anything through the mail so far. I was told it was a tax-free event.
It is a tax-free event. Was the TOD account, like, was it a savings account or a mutual fund or...
Yeah, it was set up. Her financial advisor had set it up in mutual funds.
Okay, but it wasn't an IRA or anything like that?
No, not that I know.
Okay. There's generally not a taxation when the money moves from the previous owner to you in the form of inheritance. The notion that anybody pays estate taxes is generally not true. It happens. They're in the law, but the amounts are generally have to be over $5 million before any estate tax kicks in. What can happen, though, Mark, is that there are a couple different tax events. One is that if it's an IRA and you pull the money out, then you may have to pay taxes on it as ordinary income. Same thing if it's a tax-deferred annuity and you pull the money out. Again, that can be tax-deferred income. And the third thing is if you have sold those investments, the bad news is you have to pay capital gains taxes on any capital gains. The good news is you generally get what is known as a stepped-up cost basis, meaning that the price of the securities, no matter what the person who gave them to you paid for it, the new price is the price on the date that person passed away, which is generally higher than what it was when they bought it. And so therefore, if you sell it soon, it's unlikely that there'll be any capital gains, and therefore it's unlikely you'll pay any capital gains tax. And if you do sell anything like that, you should get a 1099 for any type of withdrawals or sales.
Thanks for the call, Mark. Dee in Carpentersville, Illinois is with us. Hi, Dee.
Hello, Dee. Hello, how are you?
I'm good. What's your question?
Yes, I'm self-employed, and I need to know what I need to do to get a 401k.
Have you already decided a 401k is the best thing for you, Dee, or are you looking for any kind of retirement savings option?
401k.
Okay. How did you reach that conclusion?
I used to work for Motorola, and I had a 401k then.
Okay. Yeah, the 401ks are usually provided by large companies like Motorola, and they can be great, especially if you contribute to it. If you're self-employed, though, you have more options other than just the 401k. There is such a thing called a solo 401k that you can use. Do you know offhand, Dee, if you don't mind me asking, about how much you're looking to set aside each year in the retirement plan?
For a starter, it would be $1,000.
Okay. If you're going to use $1,000, then that's not worth the paperwork and the hassle of opening up a solo 401k. You should just open up an IRA or a Roth IRA. And if you're going to be in a higher income tax bracket, the IRA is better, and you can contribute up to $5,500 into that or your earnings, whichever is less, and another $1,000 above that if you're over 50. Same thing for the Roth IRA. The difference is, of course, you don't get a tax break on the contribution, but when you pull the money out in retirement, it will generally be tax-free. So if you're making a lot of money, use the IRA. If you're not making much money right now, use the Roth IRA.
Yeah, thank you very much.
Thank you, Dee. Good luck. Angie in Milwaukee has a question. Hi, Angie.
Hi. I'm calling because my husband and I are struggling with some credit issues. We have some incorrect things on our credit report. We have to boost our score, and we don't really have the knowledge right now that it takes to fix these things. I was wondering if this is something that I can do myself or if I need to be referred to a credit restoration company. I did call one, and they were quite pricey, and so I wasn't sure. And I heard horror stories, so I just need some advice.
Yeah, it's one of those things where they probably overpromise and overcharge. It's like a lot of services that, you know, it's no different from mowing your lawn, that you can do it yourself a lot cheaper, but you might not want to do it. And I would suggest in this case, Angie, that you're probably going to be better off doing it yourself. Have you contacted the credit bureau in question yet?
No, I did receive my credit report, though, and saw some things on there that I know are incorrect.
Okay, that's actually good that you know that and you've received the report. Put the information in writing when you contact the credit bureau and tell them what's going on with it, and make sure you have any documentation that goes along with it, copies only, not the originals, and send that in with it too, and then see if you can get a case going with them, and then track it hopefully so that they can make the changes. It is tricky. It's not going to happen quickly if it happens at all, because you are kind of trying to prove a negative, but the fact that you're making an effort, a lot of times the credit bureau is most interested in just having the information be accurate, and so they're not just going, they have nothing to gain by having inaccurate information in there. But trying to get negative information off there can be very tough, but I think you can do it yourself and save the money.
So is there a place that I can go, or a resource that is good for learning about credit, and what is the best thing to do as far as canceling credit cards or paying off collections or that type of thing?
Sure. The if it's credit score in particular, that myfico.com site that we mentioned is pretty good, as is creditkarma.com. Again, it's advertising supported, but they're offering more and more services that are technically for free. I would also, if the issue is the dollar amount of the debt and not the inaccurate information, the scores, check out debtadvice.org. Debtadvice.org, they not only have a lot of articles at the site, but they also have links to reputable credit counselors there. And again, debtadvice.org, and we'll have that up at onyourmoney.com later on.
Good luck, Angie. Thank you for calling. Stephanie emails, I would like to retire at about age 52. Well, wouldn't we all, Stephanie? That's pretty good. I am trying to save money for living expenses for the period when I won't be able to draw down from my retirement savings without penalty. Should I put my money into an IRA, then convert it to a Roth when I quit working, or should I just save my money for the gap period in a regular investment account? Also, any good sources for calculating lump sum payment for pensions?
That is actually a great question, especially if she's, you know, not wanting to retire at 52 and she's 51 and a half right now or something. I would, I think that the strategy of saving three different ways, one in the tax-deferred accounts like 401ks or IRAs, and then second in Roth IRAs if you qualify, and then third, setting up a slush fund, because a lot of people who are able to retire in their 50s have an issue where they may have accumulated a lot of money in an IRA or 401k, but pulling it out can be very difficult and it's taxable. And so the slush fund can help mitigate the damage that taxes can do to someone while they're waiting for to reach 59 and a half or get to Social Security. So I think it's a good idea to accumulate savings in the 401k first, Roth IRA second, and then in the savings third. And in terms of calculators, there's a website run out of the Twin Cities, and actually a lot of financial services companies license the software from this company. It's called dinkytown.net, dinkytown.net. And as people familiar with Twin Cities know, that's the name of an area near the University of Minnesota campus. And dinkytown.net has a lot of free calculators that you can use, not just for retirement planning, but insurance, investments, and they're all free.
All right. Good luck to Stephanie. So what's the website of the week?
Well, a listener named Mark heard us talking about trying to find a better rate on safe money, and he sent in one that he's been very happy with called checkingfinder.com. Checkingfinder.com allows you to search for different checking and savings account providers in your area or nationwide if you can qualify, so you can hopefully get a better yield or maybe lower fees or both on your safe money. Checkingfinder.com, and again, we'll put that up at onyourmoney.com as well.
All right, and we have Kevin's going to have next week off, but we'll be back the week after that with so much more information and advice on your money. Time for four more words before we go, Kevin.
Spend less, have more.
Kevin McKinley is a certified financial planner and managing member of McKinley Money LLC. He is with us just about every week at this time, with information and advice on your money. As mentioned, Kevin is off next week. We will have a fill-in financial expert to answer your personal financial questions. And then we will both be back the week after that for another edition of On Your Money. Thanks to Bill Martins and to Christy Taylor for producing and directing this program. Thank you for listening. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network.